Welcome to a Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. So today we're tackling a really heavy one. We're going deep into Cormac McCarthy's 1985 novel, Blood Meridian, or The Evening Redness in the West. And for anyone who hasn't read it, maybe a word of warning, this isn't your typical novel. It's more like this terrifying, vast philosophical epic, and it completely upends the traditional American Western.
Oh, absolutely. It's essential reading, I think, but yeah, profoundly difficult. McCarthy, well, people often compare him to Faulkner, to Melville, and it's easy to see why. His writing style, it really demands something from you.
How so?
Well, it's sparse, but also incredibly lyrical. Almost biblical sometimes. And then there's the famous lack of, you know, standard punctuation, no quotation marks for dialogue.
Right. That style hits you immediately. It's disorienting. And I have to think that's deliberate. By taking away those speech marks, the dialogue and the narration just kind of bleed together. It throws you right into the middle of this relentless, violent world the story creates.
Exactly.
So our goal today, our mission for this deep dive, is maybe to figure out why this book, which is essentially just pages and pages of brutal, almost senseless slaughter, is seen as McCarthy's masterpiece, his magnum opus.
Well, I think it's because it completely demolishes any romantic ideas about the American frontier. It just strips it all away. The story itself is loosely based on real history, the Glanton Gang, a group of scalp hunters back in the mid-1800s.
Yeah, I've heard of them. Notorious.
Very. And McCarthy uses that horrifying historical backdrop to pose this really fundamental, chilling question. Is violence... is it just something that goes wrong sometimes in human nature, an aberration? Or is it actually the core truth, the unchangeable, maybe even eternal reality of who we are?
That's a heavy question to build a novel around. Okay, so let's start the journey. The setting. You mentioned the landscape is key. The American Southwest, northern Mexico around 1850.
Yeah, and it's punishing. It feels ancient, vast, and completely indifferent to the human drama unfolding on it. It's almost another character.
And who leads us into this world?
Our entry point is a figure known only as the Kid. He's defined almost by absence. He's nameless, comes from poverty in Tennessee, and right from the start, he seems to have this innate capacity for violence. Runs away at 14.
So not exactly a clear hero figure, or even an anti-hero?
No, not really. For most of the book, he's more like a blank slate, a reluctant witness, just drifting westwards. The world, the darkness of it, kind of writes itself onto him as he goes.
And how does he get tangled up in the main plot? With the game.
His first real taste of organized violence is joining this doomed filibustering group led by Captain White. They're trying to claim Mexican land.
Doesn't sound like it ends well.
It doesn't. They get completely wiped out by Comanches. It's an incredibly visceral, horrific scene in the book, like a baptism by fire, you could say.
And surviving that leads him where?
Directly into the path of the main group. He gets arrested, and while he's recovering, he gets recruited into the Glanton Gang.
The scalp hunters.
The scalp hunters. Their initial job, their contract, is straightforward enough, if grim. Mexican authorities hire them to hunt Apache Indians. They get paid per scalp.
But I get the feeling it doesn't stay that simple.
Not at all. This is where it spirals. The mission just dissolves. Greed takes over. And this terrifying lust for violence itself. The gang stops making any distinctions.
Between who?
Between anyone. Apache warriors, peaceful Mexican villagers, other Native American groups, Mexican soldiers, American travelers. Anyone who crosses their path becomes a potential target, a source of scalps, of profit.
So the violence becomes the point, not the means to an end.
Exactly. The original economic reason just evaporates. They become this engine of pure chaos, killing for killing's sake and for the money it brings, no matter the source. It shows the violence isn't functional anymore. It's philosophical.
And that philosophical dimension, that seems to bring us to Judge Holden. He feels like maybe the most unforgettable and terrifying character in modern literature. Why is he even necessary? Couldn't Glanton, the leader, just embody the violence?
Well, Glanton is the engine, in a way. He's the pragmatic force, pure rage, pure greed. But the judge, he's the ideology behind it. He's the one who elevates this from just a bloody historical episode into something, well, epic. Something about the very nature of evil.
Describe him for someone who hasn't encountered him.
Physically, he's arresting. Huge. 7 feet tall, completely bald, no hair anywhere, pale skin. But then he's also incredibly intelligent. A polymath, speaks multiple languages, knows science, philosophy. He's the gang's intellectual guide, their spiritual leader in a twisted sense.
He makes their killing almost sacred.
Yes. He basically argues that war is the ultimate reality. War is God. He sees conflict not as a breakdown of society, but as its fundamental state, the divine bedrock of all existence.
So he's not just violent, he gives violence a kind of theology.
Precisely. He declares war is God. It's this necessary, eternal ritual that sorts everything out, that determines value.
Mm-hmm.
And that belief gives every horrific act they commit this chilling, almost religious weight.
There's that detail about his ledger, too. He's always sketching things from nature, right? Documenting them. But then he destroys the specimens. What's that about?
Ah, yes. That's absolutely key to his whole worldview.
Yeah.
It comes down to that famous bone-chilling line. He says, "Whatever in creation exists without my knowledge exists without my consent."
Wow.
Yeah. He believes that by knowing something, by documenting it, he owns it. He controls it. And if something exists outside his knowledge or acts against his will, like a specimen he draws, or, say, a person who resists his philosophy, well, that's an insult to his self-proclaimed divinity. It has to be erased to maintain his absolute order.
So the landscape, the animals, the people, they're all just things to be cataloged and then discarded or destroyed to prove his point, his power.
Exactly. Which brings us back to the kid. Why does the judge seem particularly focused on him? The kid kills, he participates, but there's something different there.
What is it?
It's kritish, almost invisible sometimes. But there are these tiny flickers of maybe moral awareness, small acts of mercy, moments of hesitation or restraint. And in the judge's world, where everything must serve war, must serve him, any deviation is unacceptable.
So that little bit of conscience makes the kid a problem, a false stone, as the book says, in the judge's perfect structure of violence. He's a witness who hasn't fully bought in.
Right, a dangerous witness. And he's not the only one who sees the judge for what he might be. You have Tobin, the ex-priest in the gang.
What's his role?
Tobin is sort of the flawed moral counterpoint. He still clings to bits of his old faith, his old morality, even amidst the horror. And significantly, it's Tobin who explicitly suggests the judge isn't just human, maybe something supernatural, demonic even. He represents a world where that old morality hasn't just lost, it's seen its own executioner.
Okay, so the plot itself, it feels less like a traditional story arc and more like episodes, a relentless series of massacres.
It is episodic, a chronicle of horrors. The action rarely lets up. And that vast, indifferent landscape you mentioned earlier, it's the perfect stage. Totally uncaring about the bloodshed.
Does the violence keep escalating?
It does. It goes beyond any rational motivation into pure depravity. Eventually, the gang becomes so notorious they're outcasts, hunted by the same Mexican and American authorities who might have initially hired or tolerated them. They flee towards Arizona.
And what happens there?
They reach the Yuma River crossing, and there they commit their final fatal act of hubris. They seize control of the ferry.
So controlling the crossing point.
Yes. But they don't just run it. They start robbing and murdering travelers indiscriminately. It's not about scalps anymore. It's pure predation. Absolute power corrupting absolutely, you might say.
That sounds like pushing things too far.
It is. And the retribution is swift and brutal. The Yuma Indians, whose ferry they stole and whose people they likely harmed, launch a surprise attack. Glanton, the leader, and most of the gang are killed right there. Their reign ends in a sudden violent slaughter.
Does the kid survive this?
The kid and Tobin manage to escape, wounded, back into the desert. Their immediate fate is left hanging, but they're alive. But then the narrative jumps.
How far?
Years forward. We see the kid drifting through the West. He's older now, but haunted. Always aware, somehow, that the judge is still out there, unchanged, unaged, and still hunting him.
So there's a final confrontation.
There is. Decades later. The kid is middle-aged, about 45. It happens in a saloon in Fort Griffin, Texas. The judge finds him, still looking exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Massive, pale, hairless.
Yeah.
The judge corners the kid in an outhouse. McCarthy. He doesn't show us what happens. It's off-screen. The kid's fate is sealed, but the withholding of the details, you know, makes it almost more terrifying.
Definitely. What happens after?
The judge just walks back into the saloon, and he starts dancing, fiddling. And he proclaims to everyone there that he will never die, that he will never sleep. He's this triumphant, eternal figure of violence. Having finally snuffed out that last little flicker of resistance the kid represented, it feels like a total victory for his worldview.
A completely deterministic ending. Okay, let's pull back and talk themes.
Sure.
Because that's why this book sticks with you. It's seen as this ultimate takedown of manifest destiny.
Well, absolutely. It shreds that whole idea. The westward expansion in this telling isn't about civilizing or progress. It's shown as a brutal, genocidal conquest driven by greed and, importantly, sanctioned violence. The novel makes it clear the scalp hunters often worked with the blessing, or at least the blind eye, of authorities.
So the violence wasn't just incidental, it was the tool of expansion.
It was the primary mechanism. And that leads back to that crushing feeling you mentioned. Determinism versus free will. Does the kid's tiny spark of mercy, his brief moments of choosing not to participate fully, ever stand a chance against the overwhelming force the judge represents?
And the ending seems to say, maybe not.
The ending strongly suggests that individual moral choice is incredibly fragile, perhaps even futile when faced with the sheer scale and structure of human savagery, which the judge embodies. He is that seemingly unchangeable foundation.
We have to touch on the style again, though. It's so crucial. That third-person narrator, detached, almost biblical in tone, describing these horrific events.
That detachment is key. It's terrifying because it offers no comfort, no judgment. It just lays it bare. And you mentioned polysyndeton earlier, that repeated use of and.
Yes. It sounds academic, but what does it actually do when you're reading it?
It creates this relentless, overwhelming flow. Instead of short, sharp actions, McCarthy often strings them together with and.
Yeah.
It makes the violence feel continuous, inevitable, almost ritualistic. It gives the writing this archaic weight, mirroring the judge's idea of war as this eternal ceremony.
That contrast, the beautiful, almost elevated language describing utter depravity, that's what makes it so profoundly unsettling, I think.
I agree. It doesn't aim for empathy in the usual sense. It produces dread, philosophical terror. The symbolism is everywhere, too, like you said. The evening redness in the west, the title itself suggests this constant stain of blood on the horizon of history.
And the judge himself, meticulously noting everything down.
He symbolizes that terrifying human drive to dominate existence. Not for understanding, but for control. For power.
It really forces you, the reader, to look right into that abyss, to confront the idea that maybe this capacity for systematic, intelligent evil isn't just out there in history, but potentially latent in, well, in all of us, always waiting.
And that unflinching stare is why it's still so necessary, isn't it? It makes us grapple with the violent foundations of so much history. It refuses to give us easy heroes or simple moral lessons.
Yeah, there's no comfort here. By swapping the romantic Western hero for this philosophical monster, McCarthy just fundamentally changed American literature. He forces us to consider violence not just as something that happens, but maybe as part of the human condition itself.
A truly radical and enduring work. It stays with you long after you finish it.
It certainly does. A difficult journey, but a vital one. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.